And so this talk is on taking delight in this process. And I want to tell you a story that's had quite an influence on me in terms of taking delight, at least in my world, my outer world. They always say in the Buddhist teachings, and probably lots of other teachings too, that looking out is actually very helpful. Not like not ever knowing what's going on with yourself, but somehow the focus isn't on self-absorption, but it's like poking your head out of the cocoon and realizing there's this huge sky or this huge world. Because if we can train in sort of becoming curious and having an appetite for our life in general, take an interest in the foliage or the birds or the sounds or the music or the expressions on people's faces or whatever it might be. I remember a few years ago leading one of the six-week city retreats, I had people look at people as an exercise, and I asked them to do it if they were in traffic jams. Not just in general, but look at individuals and then see them come into focus as a real person. And basically the exercise is called Just Like Me, that just like me, that person doesn't want to be caught up in worry, doesn't want to feel depression, doesn't want a heavy heart. Just like me, that person would like to have some comfort in their life, have someone love them or respect them, care for them. But in fact, it almost doesn't matter what you're saying to yourself. It's just that you focus in on someone who's just the nameless masses and they become real. So in the same way, we start doing that with our emotions, and we begin to sort of give them some attention, not in the sense that we usually do of getting hooked of the shenpa, but noticing them and willing to know them, willing to experience the energy without the shenpa, just that naked quality of the emotions. So the story is about Jarvis Masters. And I've often talked about Jarvis, and I've often taught little bits about some of his stories. And so this story is that Jarvis went from a nightmare childhood. He loved his mother really dearly. You can't say anything bad about his mother to Jarvis. But he also acknowledges now that she loved the kids, but she was I forget what her drug of choice was, but I think coke. It might have been crack. In any case, she was never there. And these little ones, when there were quite a few of them, they were left alone for days and days in these apartments without anything to eat. And then she would come home and she would just pass out, and they would stroke her hair and rub her hands and stuff. But basically, it was pretty sad. And eventually, they were taken from her. And it got worse than that from other people in their life. There was a lot of violence, and Jarvis' father used to hold him between his knees and smack him hard over and over and said, "I want you to get mad, I want you to get mad." And he used to get really mad and actually want to kill his father. So it's not too surprising that then when he went from that into foster homes, which kept shifting and changing, that he became a really mean youth. And he started doing some really mean things. And so for armed robbery, he was put in jail in San Quentin. Then he was accused of being part of a conspiracy for the murder of Sergeant Butterfield, who was an officer at San Quentin. It was a terrible thing. We all feel really strongly, and there's a lot of proof, actually, now, that he's innocent. He's so funny. He said, "I was part of the gang that did it, and they wanted me to sharpen the weapon," which is what he's accused of doing. "But I did it too slow, so they bumped me, and I didn't get to do it." So he said, "I didn't actually do it." He said, "I was mean enough, I would have done it. It didn't mean anything to me at the time, but my good fortune is that I know that I had no part in the killing of Sergeant Butterfield." I don't know how old he was then, 18 or 19 or something like that. And he said what happened during the trial is all these people who had known him all his life were coming in and testifying on his behalf, people who'd been the foster parents and patrol officers and a lot of people, and he was just like, "Are they talking about me?" And he said he became interested in meditation because he wanted to know who he was, that he just felt he had no idea who he was. And he became very involved in meditation. Then he had a Buddhist teacher, Chogdud Rinpoche. Now Jarvis is one of these amazing people that works with a lot of real hard stuff all the time. And he's just dedicated to helping other people and working with his own stuff, and he's an amazing person. So he's been in San Quentin 22 years on death row. He's not accused of killing the officer. They know he didn't do that. He was in the other part of the prison. He's accused of sharpening the weapon. And the person who killed the officer and one others, they got life sentence, but he got the death penalty. It's very strange. But in any case, this is what happened. When we go to see Jarvis in San Quentin, we talk through this hole in the wall. It's not even a phone. And it's so hard to hear. We can hardly hear because everyone's talking to their families up and down, and he can't hear very well. So he's clever, and he's been in San Quentin a long time. He knows the ropes. He applied for the hearing-impaired phone. And so they said, oh, you can't have that unless you have an ear examination. So about a month ago or so, they came in the morning, and they put him in an orange jumpsuit, and they started taking him someplace, and he didn't know where he was going. They weren't telling him. And then they walked out of the gates of San Quentin. And he said he was terrified. He had no idea what was about to happen. And they got in these cars and armed police officers escorting him. And then the officer sitting next to him said, so Jarvis, what's wrong with your ears anyway? Then he knew he was going to get his ear exam. And then he said from that moment, he had 2 hours of freedom. He just pressed his nose up against the window and he just looked at the world that he hadn't seen in 22 years. And it's kind of quite a story, isn't it? So there was no problem with staying. He was completely present. He saw everything. And he was just like drinking it up. And then he went back into San Quentin, which has been actually hard. So when I heard that, it just had this effect on me. I started this practice of seeing the world as if you only had this little time out and then you weren't going to see it anymore. It's a wonderful practice to just take the attitude that you don't have very long and then you just look that way. And it's nothing that you actually contrive or make a particular effort. You just look at people and things with a tremendous curiosity and interest. So I think this is a wonderful story on learning to stay. But when I do it, and if you do it, then what you'll find is that usually you don't stay for 2 hours, maybe like 5 minutes, or as long as it's entertaining, actually, is how long it lasts usually. And then thoughts distract you. You see something and you're off in a train of thought, and the next thing you know, you're lost in thought. And then usually the Shenpas come up around various things that you see and things you hear and things that are said to you. And basically, you begin to realize that the Shenpa is blinding you to the enjoyment of life. This is very helpful if that begins to happen, that recognition. Because if you go from the wonder of a child and the appreciation and curiosity and appetite for life into this cocoon of mind and hooked by Shenpa, it's painful. And even though you equate that with comfort and there's still the urge to follow it, you know that you would rather learn to stay present and be awake and open to life. And so in terms of taking delight in the self-reflection, when you see that you've done it again and that you're doing it again and that you can't even stop doing it again or how whatever the scenario is, instead of beating yourself up and adding another major Shenpa to the whole mix, take delight that you see that you're doing that and then just come back to looking, seeing, being, staying present. That helps if what you're coming back to feels like a source of delight and a source of energy and glad to be alive for you. We need everything that we can get to not turn the seeing of the shenpa, the seeing of the thinking, the seeing of the habitual pattern running itself again, the seeing that we just lost our temper and broke up the house, the seeing that we just went on a binge, the seeing. We need a lot of help to not then take that and feed the self-denigration. It's the biggest shenpa probably going in the West, the self-loathing or the self-denigration, this low sense of self-esteem, this feeling of badness about ourselves. So